We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me this morning is Lawrence Lepard from Equity Management Associates, EMA2. Larry, how are you today? Thanks for joining me again.
I'm doing great, Tom. Really nice to see you and always fun to be on your show.
Absolutely. It's great to have you back. And, you know, it's interesting to always, you know, be able to look back over these conversations that you and I have, you know, every quarter or every couple months, and see how things are changing here. You know, there's so many times that you and I have talked about something specific, but I think the general theme of what you and I have spoken about quite a bit is really playing out and starting to take shape here. I wanted to start today by talking about inflation. You know, we've seen a higher print again here yesterday. We're recording this on the morning of Wednesday, March 13th. And so I want to get your view on how you see the inflationary picture playing out over 2024 here. Do you expect waves of inflation like the 70s?
I really do. I mean, over the next few years, I'm very much in line with my friend Tavi Costa's chart, which is, you know, you get an inflationary impulse and then it backs off, and then you get another one and it backs off. And there were three waves in the 70s. And so I think, you know, we hit peak deflation in March of 2020, and we now live in an inflationary world. And despite all the deniers, you know, and the deflationists and, you know, the Fed and everyone else saying we're going back to 2%, I just don't see that. I mean, I look at all the wage agreements, I look at, you know, the natural resource pricing, et cetera. And I think we are in an inflationary world now. And I think yesterday's print, although it's just one of many and they're noisy and the numbers are cooked. So, you know, we're talking about something that's very, you know, hard to measure with any accuracy. But I know that from a consumer point of view, everyone listening to this would agree that, you know, clearly inflation has not stopped. And, you know, it's slowed down from its peak, but it's not stopped. And particularly in the things that we buy every day, you know, we see it. We see it at the supermarket in a big way. And more recently we've seen it in gasoline. And I think the Fed Treasury have an active policy to weaken the dollar, which I think will push up the price of oil. And to me, probably the biggest inflation indicator for the average, you know, American in North America is, you know, Canada and North America is gasoline prices. And as oil prices go up, we'll see gasoline prices go up. And so the Fed really is trapped. In my view, we have inflation that cannot be tamped down. I mean, the perfect indicators, you know, the average wage increases are running well north of 5%. And so, you know, how do you get back to 2% when one of your major inputs into costs is going up at 5%? I mean, you just can't. So I'm with you, and I'm with those who think that we have continued inflation that's a problem.
So is the wage growth a problem because it can drive this inflationary wage price spiral?
I think that's right. I think that, you know, they have to, you know, companies are going to try to maintain their margins. I mean, to some degree, they can decrease margins and company profitability can go down as, you know, wage costs go up. But, you know, it's as one of the larger inputs into many, many things. It in my view, will drive, it'll be what will drive inflation, you know, on a go forward basis. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty simple. I mean, you know, people cannot afford to, you know, to do the basic things they used to be able to do. And so they either work another job or demand more wages. I mean, one of the things I think both you and I would find somewhat unusual and not what we expected to see is that the labor market has been much stronger than we thought. And that's, you know, that's a good thing in a certain sense. People are working, but it's a bad thing from an inflation point of view because there's not excess labor and therefore wages. People are getting the wage increases they're asking for. I mean, the pilots, when they pushed hard, and there's a shortage in pilots now, apparently, you know, they were getting north of 10, 15, 20% a year annualized increases. I mean, that flows through everywhere in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I think the argument can be made that, you know, if we're only seeing 5% increases, I think that could be, I think that could be said that it is not enough to really drive that cycle. Yet if we're seeing on the higher end, you know, the more well-paying jobs end up being 10, 15, 20%, that seems to probably trickle through the economy more, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. you know, it's a mess. It's there's no other way to say it. It's a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Larry, do you think that the 70s is actually a good analog for the current inflationary period, or are the driving forces right now much different?
That's a great question. And I'm not a professional economist, and I've talked to professional economists who say they're different. And as you know, as we all know, the 70s, a lot of that was driven by the Arab oil embargo. And it was a slightly, you know, it was a different economy back then. We've got a much more efficient economy today than we had in the 70s. So I don't think they're exactly analogous, but I think they will rhyme. And it tends to be, you know, and I'm not quite sure how all the factors play into it, but it tends to be that these things are very, very cyclical. And you have, you know, very, very long periods of deflation, and then you have, shorter but significant periods of inflation. And, you know, when we had negative interest rates and negative, you know, interest rates in 2020 and all the deflationary factors that we had going into the last 40 years, you know, those have suddenly, or not suddenly, but kind of consistently reversed. You know, there were a lot of good things that happened that created the deflation of the last, you know, 30 years. I mean, we had, you know, a billion people in China coming on and making things cheaply. We had, you know, a huge amount of shale oil found in the United States that, you know, that helped with our energy balance. You know, we had just a lot of technological development that improved things, you know, et cetera. So, you know, a lot of those trends appear to be somewhat ending. And as in my opinion, as a result of those ends, you know, we're going to enter a period. And also I guess you know, we're really missing the big one, Tom, which, you know, we haven't just talked about yet, but the big one is that, you know, the monetary policies have really changed. I mean, you know, the growth of the Fed balance sheet in 2020 has been just, you know, stunning, you know, in terms of size. I mean, we went from a 3.7 balance sheet to a $9 trillion balance sheet in, you know, a very rapid period of time as a result of the response to the COVID crisis. So, you know, it's that you can't grow the monetary base, excuse me, or M2 by 40%. And not think that that's going to have some, you know, a very serious impact upon inflation. And I think, you know, as you know, and I know, inflation is not just, you know, what's going on monetarily, but it's also what expectations are and what human behavior is. And so if people think prices are going up, they'll buy things before prices go up. And of course, that'll be self-fulfilling. That'll create more demand and so forth. So, and I think we're seeing that, you know, there's the psychology has now changed. I mean, there was a time when, you know, the psychology was, there is no inflation. It's not something to worry about. Now the psychology is, you know, we clearly do have inflation. And so that has changed. So,
well, you know, as you're talking about how expectations are driving, you know, particular forces within the economy, within the markets, it's interesting to me to try to wrap my head around the Fed, you know, speaking about pivoting, let's say when Jay Powell came out in mid-December 23 and really changing his posture, but, you know, just by changing his verbiage, the markets eased financial conditions for them. So how does that work, Larry, that the market is able to ease financial conditions without the Fed actually, you know, overtly making a change?
Yeah, that's a fabulous point, Tom. And it's really, isn't it amazing that the entire world, you know, bases its economic and financial decisions upon, you know, what a small unelected group of people say, right? And, you know, the bond market kind of, you know, controls the world in a lot of respects. And I think what you're alluding to is what happened this fall. And I wrote about it in my last quarterly report, which is to say the interest rates started going up rather sharply and the 10-year got close to 5%. And the Fed basically panicked and realized that, you know, if we had much higher interest rates over a longer period of time, that, you know, that was going to create increased, you know, fiscal dominance and trouble for them economically. And so, you know, you saw in rapid succession, you know, 10 or 12 Fed governors coming out saying, no, we're talking about dropping rates. And of course, you know, the financial markets are forward looking. And what people tried to do is they realized, all right, if the Fed's going to drop rates, I know what this means. You know, I buy, if dropping rates will increase the value of these underlying bonds that are paying a higher rate, so I'm going to buy them. And so, you know, people try to front run the Fed. So you get these markets kind of guessing as to what these monetary, you know, policymakers are going to do. And that's how they were able to jawbone, you know, a shorter term response in their favor. You know, the negative is that they, you know, these things don't last, right? I mean, they can say this, that people can jump in a certain direction. But the fact of the matter is, if the fundamentals aren't there and they don't drop rates, eventually the market will correct and go back to where it was. So, you know, what I believe happens is they, you know, they at critical points in time, they come out and say what they want to say in order to try and push people into a direction that benefits their narrative. That's the long and the short of it. But underlying it all, there are the true economic factors which are taking place. And in my opinion, let's get to the bottom line. We are in a sovereign debt crisis, which then I think is going to lead to a currency crisis. And because of those two core principles, you know, no matter what they say, I think the bond market is at great risk of, as this becomes more widely known and a larger portion of the population comes to view the world the way I view the world, which is to say that inflation is an ongoing problem as a result of a lot of factors, many of which are monetary in the way they've run the thing. The bond market is going to sell off and rates are going to go higher. And that creates this fiscal doom loop, which, you know, is, I mean, we're already spending $1 trillion a year on interest on the federal debt. And if the federal, and that's at an average interest rate of 3.1%. If interest rates continue to go higher, that's going to get larger. It's going to make the deficit larger. They're going to have to sell more bonds and so on and so forth. And, you know, wash, rinse, repeat until there is no bond market, or, you know, you're at 10% interest rates and everything's collapsing. So what that then forces them, what I'm describing here is the fact that they're trapped. What that then forces them to do is ultimately enter into something called yield curve control, which is to say they use their policy, or they use their, you know, their tools to actually buy the bonds themselves. And by the way, we might have just crossed that Rubicon, as you and I were just speaking about before the show, with this ISTA letter. So
can you elaborate on that, Larry?
What? Yeah, right. I'm sure you want me to go there. Okay. So it's the ISTA letter. So ISTA is the International Swaps and Dealers Association. It's a group that regulates derivatives, or International Swaps and Derivatives Association. It's a group that regulates derivatives and swaps and kind of the plumbing of the financial system. And they wrote a letter to the Federal Reserve Board saying that they believe that the market for treasuries is becoming less liquid, and that is problematic. Mm-hmm. And that as a result, and by the way, that's occurring because there's less demand for treasuries. And as James Lavish and others have pointed out, we've had some treasury auctions which have been really sloppy in the last 6 months. And as a result of that, they believe that the Fed should take a change in their policy, which is to eliminate something called the SLR, which is the supplementary leverage ratio, which is a ratio that requires banks to limit the amount of bonds that they, U.S. bonds that they put on their balance sheet, and not become too leveraged with those bonds. And this is something that they did in 2020 when the COVID crisis occurred and the U.S. bond market became very shaky in that time frame before they, you know, as they responded to all the problems. They eliminated the SLR. And what that did was it allowed the banks to buy every last treasury they wanted without any repercussions or any limits. And so, and of course, they didn't keep that drop in the rules on forever. They ultimately unwound it. I don't know the exact date. You can look it up. But what they're talking about, what this ISTA Association is now talking about, is bringing that back. And really what this would allow the banks to do is buy the entire federal deficit. And of course, the Fed would like that, the Treasury would like that, and Congress and the Senate would like that. And so, and they would do it with just newly printed money because the Fed has the ability to create reserves. You know, they can create loans, they can create a loan, they can create an asset at the same time. And so, effectively, this is unlimited QE. Now, it's not called that. And of course, this is because to call it that would, you know, if today the Fed were, for example, reverse QT and start QE or start yield curve control, the entire world would know what that meant, and they would know that that was enormously inflationary. Mm-hmm. and inflation expectations would go up and the bond market would go down. And so the Fed can't do that. That does not serve their interests. But what this nice little regulation change does is it allows the banks to do it. And so, you know, just as these people, you know, on the other side of the trade that we, you know, as you're on the, you and I are all, you know, all of us are on the sound money trade, which is we want to invest in assets that can't be, you know, diluted. You know, the Fed is on the other side of the trade. They want to continue to dilute the assets without all of us knowing and pretend that it's not happening. And, you know, they've managed to throughout, you know, the last 100 years of their doing it, more than 100, they founded 1913. But, you know, they managed to keep coming up with new ways to fool us. And this is the most recent one, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, don't worry, we're not doing QE. But guess what? We've got a way we can let the banks do QE. And so, you know, this is why those of us in sound money, you know, as we always say, is all roads lead to Rome, which is to say all roads lead to money printing and printer go burr. So this is another form of that. It's subtle, it's tricky, it's inside baseball, and it's monetary plumbing, but it gets you to the same place, which is the Fed is running deficits which are too large, and the they're now going to co-opt the banks. This is just a letter advising, as the Fed has not taken this step yet. Mm-hmm. But usually the way these things occur is somebody talks about writing a letter and it gets out there and they float the idea, and then it won't be long before they do take this step. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of this, if it occurs, you know, this will be, you know, backdoor monetization of the deficit, you know, full stop. And so, you know, which means more growth in the money supply, more dilution of the existing currency, and more need to buy assets which the government can't print, which is, you know, the business you're in, the business I'm in, the business all sound money people are in, because we know the government's broken and they can't stop printing. So,
So Larry, does that, you know, what are the mechanics of that look like? Does that end up as a major growth of the Fed's balance sheet again?
Well, no, not necessarily, because really it'll end up you'll see it on the bank balance sheets. You'll see the bank balance sheets swelling as they increasingly buy treasury bonds. You will continue to see, you know, the debt grow, and you'll also see it in the growth of the debt. And we've already seen that, by the way. I mean, I'm sure you're aware. We just saw it was widely noted that, you know, the debt went up $1 trillion in 100 days, right? So they're 365 days in a year. So, you know, annualize that, right? I mean, this is, you know, this train is really out of control. You know, I mean, the last quarter U.S. federal budget deficit was $500 billion. So we're running at by the way, I think it's accelerating. So I think we're running at north of a $2 trillion U.S. federal budget deficit. And we just saw, you know, the Biden administration a week or two ago push through another $468 billion. And, you know, it's an election year, so we know they've got their foot on the accelerator there. I mean, you know, there is just no stopping, you know, the fiscal irresponsibility. And really the only thing that would make our trade not work, I mean, the only way that they can, you know, return sound money or you know, go in a direction that's adverse to us is to exhibit fiscal restraint and responsibility in Washington, D.C., and that's just not happening. I mean, there's, in fact, quite the opposite. We're going in the other direction, and it would appear that we're going the other direction more rapidly. And this is, you know, I think this is what the sound money assets have noticed. I mean, we haven't gotten to it yet, but you've had gold and Bitcoin break out to new all-time highs, and, you know, at the same time. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, my way of seeing it, there's no coincidence in that, right? I mean, the markets are forward-looking. You know, Powell has not pivoted. I mean, I think my game plan, your game plan, I think if last time we discussed this, my view was, you know, the Fed will ultimately be forced to pivot hard. And when they do pivot hard, sound money assets are going to explode. Mm-hmm. Well, what's occurred since that time is the Fed really hasn't pivoted hard. The Fed they pivoted a little bit, but not hard. I mean, and, you know, they've indicated they came out with some jawboning. They said maybe the cycle of hiking is done. They said maybe a cycle of cuts is ready to begin, but then they backed off of that. You know, we're now at kind of a consensus of maybe two cuts this year, and that could be going the other direction. And yet sound money assets are exploding. And so I think the reason sound money assets are exploding is they're looking through all the things I just described. I mean, gold and Bitcoin can see, okay, we know what this means. You know, the ISTA letter, there's another clue. You know, NYCB Bank, you know, getting bailed out by a former Treasury secretary, that's another clue. You know, the BTFP thing last March, that was another clue. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think the rumors are right now that in D.C., the Fed and others perhaps are working on some kind of a program that would help the regional banks with the CRE loans. You know, the commercial real estate, we've all observed how, you know, we're seeing all these buildings that were built in the last 20 years being sold for 20 to 30 cents on the dollar. And most of the loans against those buildings were taken out, you know, they were taken out from regional banks. which originally, you know, at the time they were taken out, they looked quite sound because the buildings were rented up. New world, COVID, you know, less demand for this office space. And a lot of those buildings are getting remarked in this new environment. And this would lead to a wide scale banking problem, you know, or could lead to a wide scale banking problem. I think it might. And I, my guess is that the Fed is trying to get ahead of that. And Powell even mentioned that in his last press release. He said, you know, that some of these banks are going to fail. And we know that they're probably putting together plans to shove these smaller banks into the bigger banks and then to give the bigger banks incentives to buy them, you know, in the same way that they gave JP Morgan a big incentive to buy First Republic. So, you know, you can see that these people are, you know, they're trying to hold the wheels on the cart. But, you know, the cart keeps rolling down the road and we keep spending and printing. And, you know, this is why, in my view, you know, we're going to see $3,000 gold, you know, probably this year. So,
Larry, I want to stay on that, you know, the BTFP program for a bit. For, yeah, for those sure. that aren't familiar, the Bank Term Funding Program ended on Monday. That was kind of the bailout for these banks that failed last year around this time. So again, it ended on Monday. But as you pointed out in your last quarterly letter, this program was just a small visible part of, let's call it, the bailout. The real bailout okay. came via the Federal Home Loan Bank, as it provided over $1 trillion of liquidity to the banking system in March 2023, $100 billion more than provided in the great financial crisis of 2008. So do you think this provides more cover for the banks as the initial program ends? And you know, many were concerned about bank failures restarting here.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that it's not just the FHLB, it is that as well. But I think there's another chart in there that shows the discount window borrowings. And as we've seen, you know, the Fed has come out and publicly talked about how they want to encourage people to use the discount window. There's no shame in doing that. They've opened it up, and they've also opened up continuous swap lines. There used to be the swap lines would kind of come and go, and now they've made it very clear that the swap lines are open all the time. And so, you know, to me, all of these things, Tom, and I've heard from other people, relatives who are in the banking business, that, you know, the regulators are standing by and watching all this stuff extremely carefully, you know, extremely diligently and carefully, and they're kind of, they're ready to jump in and plug any holes. And the whole, you know, the whole model now is whatever problems arise, you know, the Fed will jump in and plug it. And that doesn't surprise me. I mean, this is, you know, we know, you know, when Silicon Valley Bank failed, there were $17 trillion of bank deposits in the United States. And if you'll recall, you know, Janet Yellen flip-flopped a couple of times. She said, well, maybe we'll guarantee them all, which, think about that, guaranteeing $17 trillion. I mean, you know, the Fed balance sheet's only nine. And, you know, and by the way, the insurance fund is like a couple hundred billion. So, you know, that's the fund that covers you up to your $250,000 deposit, right? But if they, you know, they were looking at a potentially having a nationwide bank run. And that obviously that terrified them. And that's why she floated that idea. And they were able to calm everybody down. And the BTFP, you know, got everybody to settle down and say, okay, well, let's not have a bank run. But obviously, you know, the notion of panic in the financial markets, I mean, that's why the Fed was originally created, right? To always be there with the liquidity to backstop the panic. But the cost of that is that they have to be irresponsible in terms of new monetary creation, because each panic gets slightly larger. And I've also observed that they seem to be coming a little bit more quickly. And, you know, as a result of that, I think we're getting closer and closer to the end game. I mean, you know, the first, well, there was a small panic in 98 and 2000, and there was a bigger one in 08. You know, there was a bigger one in 2019, you know, the repo blowout, then there was a huge one in 2020. And then, you know, they put things back together. And then there was a pretty good sized one in 23 with BTFP, you know, that BTFP addressed. And so, you know, these problems, I mean, you can't continue to grow the debt in excess of the growth of the underlying GDP without ultimately creating a gap that creates a problem that leads to print or go burr. And it's just straight, simple math. I mean, this is not, you know, a five-year-old can understand it. You know, and even, you know, Jay Powell, I mean, it's amazing to me some of the things he said, like, you know, we're on an unsustainable path and that'll have to be dealt with in the future. I feel like saying, dude, well, when's the future? I mean, the future's now, you know, we're there. I mean, we're, you know, we better deal with it soon or else, you know, something's going to, you know, more things are going to break and the breaks are going to get bigger. And, you know, I ultimately foresee a Fed balance sheet of, you know, $20 trillion. I mean, they're going to, you know, on the next set of things that break could be large enough that, you know, the next print will be bigger than the last. And by the way, this is, if you look through history and you look at smaller countries and other countries that have encountered this problem, this is how it happens. You know, it just, you get progressively deeper and deeper into this fiscal hole. You know, we're now, as Luke Groban points out so brilliantly, we're now at the point where, you know, we're basically, you know, our interest expense, you know, I mean, we're printing money to cover our interest expense. I mean, the deficit is larger than what we're paying, and we can't even pay the interest on what we owe, much less, you know, defense and Social Security and all the other costs we've got. So, I mean, this is a real problem. It's a real hole they've dug themselves into. And it's why, you know, it's from my point of view and investors' point of view, it's just absolutely essential that people protect themselves by having a forms of money or forms of assets, I should say, that can't be debased or printed by the government, because, you know, sadly, the government's a runaway train right now.
Mm-hmm. Larry, you mentioned this idea that really there, or we've kind of talked about this idea that the Fed is really stuck between a rock and a hard place here. You know, on one hand, they still need to fight inflation and keep rates high. But yet, on the other hand, there is a lot of debt that is coming back that needs to be refinanced this year, which only adds to this deficit, this right. need to print more money to be able to just pay the interest on the debt. So, right. you know, what do you think the Fed's options are at this point? Do they accept higher inflation and continue this fight? Or, you know, how do you see their ways out of this?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom. I mean, look, you know, they're going to do, my guess is, like most government things, they're going to kind of choose some, you know, split the baby down the middle, you know, suboptimal outcome. I mean, you know, the optimal outcome would be to do a major currency reset, you know, admit the problem, you know, and do a major currency reset right now. That's not going to happen because nobody wants to face it. You know, first of all, I mean, we've seen they've tried to define, you know, the inflation target as slightly higher. You know, you saw some people, including Krugman and others, talking about, well, maybe 3% inflation is not so bad. You know, maybe we need a higher target, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've also seen the board. I mean, I think Powell actually really does want, he truly does want to be Paul Volcker. He wants to calm inflation. The problem is, you know, he's in a pickle. He can't. I mean, to really get it under control, he'd have to go even higher than he's at right now. And if he does that, the whole thing's going to collapse. And I think he knows that. So, you know, they're trying to thread the needle and they're praying that inflation comes down enough that they can actually start to ease. Or, you know, more likely, it seems to me like what might happen is they'll stay about where they are now. And you know, the economy is, I mean, it's different. We've all learned. We all kind of thought the economy was going to fall apart, and it hasn't. And so, you know, absent the economy falling apart, we've learned that they kind of can stay at a 5% rate and things seem to be still functioning. And so my guess is they will probably try to stay there until something does clearly break and pray that inflation comes down. It probably won't. And then to the degree that that you have holes in the dam and so leaks start coming through, you know, they'll take their fingers and try and plug the holes. And I mean, the perfect recent hole was Silicon Valley Bank. Boom, they plugged it, BTFP. You know, they probably can see that there's a commercial real estate hole coming. You know, that's why there's the chatter about maybe some kind of a facility to deal with commercial real estate. You know, my guess is that they're going to kind of try and, you know, just kick the can. Because as politicians do, you know, they're not thinking 5 years out. They're thinking the next election. They're thinking keeping their jobs. They're thinking, you know, reacting. And of course, you know, my gut is at some point something really big is going to break. There's a lot of leverage in the system. There's things that none of us can foresee and understand. There's the whole, you know, derivatives complex. There's, you know, there's the basis trade. And there were some good charts, I think, in my quarterly that talked about that, how large the basis trade has grown. And you know, at some point, something will break. You know, the stock market goes down 30 or 40%. You know, the bond market sells off and interest rates go up very rapidly. And at that point in time, they'll use their emergency powers. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Because because recall that they have three mandates, you know, employment, inflation. But the third one, it's unwritten, but it's obvious because they've used it for 100 years, is to backstop the financial system. And so, you know, something will break. And then, you know, it'll be very similar to March of 2020, where, Chairman Powell said, whatever it takes, you know, whatever it takes, we're going to do whatever is absolutely necessary to keep the financial system intact. And in that case, it was growing the Fed balance sheet from, you know, $3 trillion to $9 trillion. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that's what's coming. It's at some point, something will break. And we're now at $7 trillion, and it'll go to $20 trillion. And they'll justify that. They'll say, this is all normal. This is what we have to do. We had to do it to save the system. Sure, there's some inflation as a result of it, but it's better than the alternative. And the alternative is the ATMs won't work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's in 2008, you know, Hank Paulson was begging Nancy Pelosi to give him the initial TARP program, which was, I think, $700 billion, which sounds quaint now. It's like a small number. Back then, it was a huge number. And he said, if you don't give us this to us, the ATMs won't work in the morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the financial system will literally freeze up and collapse. And so they've kind of got us, you know, they're kind of, it's like we're hostages. I mean, it's like, give us the money we need or we're going to kill the economy. You know, we're going to stick a knife in the heart of the economy. And that game just keeps playing itself out over and over and over again at larger scale. And I think, you know, more rapidly. I mean, with each of these cycles, it's getting more obvious to more people. And that's why the assets that reflect that are making record highs. And I don't think we've seen anything yet. I mean, I think, you know, in this cycle, I fully expect that, you know, gold could go to 5 or 10,000 and Bitcoin's going to go to a much higher number than it's at today. So, I think, you know, because if you historically compare our financial situation to other countries who follow the same policies, admittedly not countries with the, you know, the world's reserve currency and the biggest country in the world, but still, you know, other countries who followed our policies, what you can see is that eventually it results in, you know, one of three things. Either you have a restructuring, that's not likely in my view, or you have, you know, massive inflation, or you have hyperinflation. And I think our two choices are massive inflation or hyperinflation. It doesn't have to be hyperinflation, but we're going to have inflation. And so if that's the case, then, you know, being in sound money is more important than ever. So that's kind of how we see it.
Larry, you bring up an interesting point and something I did want to touch on here. Sure. You mentioned earlier that we've seen smaller countries, you know, go on this path. However, right. You and I were remarking that it's crazy to us to consider how long they've been able to actually keep this ball rolling in the direction that want for the most part, right? So Is there a big difference between the country that, you know, runs the reserve currency of the world and these smaller countries that don't have that luxury?
Absolutely. And that's why. I mean, the fact that we have the world's reserve currency, you know, the fact that you know, we are the leading military power, arguably, mm-hmm. You know, the fact that, you know, until we decided to screw it all up, you know, 80 or 90% of the transactions in the world were done in dollars. So there was a natural demand and a bid for dollars. Those are all very positive factors, which allowed the U.S. to behave irresponsibly and get away with it. Really since 1971, you know, with growing, you know, growing size. I mean, the U.S. has lived and we've been able to export a lot of our inflation to the, you know, to the rest of the world. So From a worldwide point of view, it's been a very unfair system where the U.S. has had the deck stacked in their favor. And that's why, you know, it's not going to disappear overnight. You know, we won World War II and we're still living off of that. Having said that, you know, there are a lot of cracks in the foundation here, you know, of this whole thing. And you can see it. We can see that. You know, the dollar is not being used as much in trade. It's down to, you know, 65% of worldwide trade now. We can see other countries trading bilaterally in their own currencies. You know, the Middle East is accepting, you know, Chinese yuan for oil. You know, and that's different. It used to all be dollar based. You know, we can see, you know, the U.S. sovereign bond market. You know, the foreigners haven't been net buyers since 2014. You know, and in fact, are slowly but surely moving away from the U.S. sovereign. I mean, we used to be able to run these deficits knowing that the rest of the world would finance them. That's not the case anymore. So, you know, it's slow. And, you know, look, we still, the U.S. still is, you know, the leading country in many respects in terms of, you know, security, rule of law, you know, et cetera. And it's broken in many ways, but still better than a lot of the alternatives. And therefore, you know, this isn't going to happen overnight. But the trend is clearly established. And more importantly, I don't necessarily look at the trend of the U.S. You know, people say, well, look at the dollar index. Well, the dollar index just measures the dollar against the euro and the yen and other paper currency. And that's really, to me, that's not the issue. Those are, you know, they're flawed currencies as well. The euro is no better than the dollar. In fact, it's worse. The yen's even worse than that. But having said that, you know, the real issue is, you know, how does the dollar compare to stuff, you know, to neutral reserve things that can't be printed? And I think, you know, kind of when I look at stuff, I look at, you know, I consider oil to be stuff. I consider gold to be stuff. You know, Bitcoin is a form of digital stuff. I mean, I know it's just ones and zeros, but, you know, it's a limited supply of ones and zeros on a ledger. And so I look at the price of, you know, the dollar, you know, of those things in dollar terms. And, you know, the dollar, as we all know, has lost 97% of its value since 1971. And I think that last 3% is going to go away at some point, too. Mm-hmm. But you know, that could be a, I mean, we can all talk about the timing on that. That doesn't happen tomorrow. You know, I think you and I discussed it earlier before the show. It probably happens, in my opinion, before 2030. You know, so what's that, you know, 6 years or so? I mean, I think we're headed in that direction with apparent acceleration in speed and magnitude or amplitude of the swings. And so, you know, it's coming, but there will be swings back and forth, no doubt, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Larry, as we're talking about how much value the U.S. dollar has lost, how far along are we here on your currency failure list? You know, you set out a list. So, you know, are those basically better indicators of the value of the dollar versus the DXY?
They are, in my opinion. I mean, I think that, you know, the thing that still amazes me, and I think it's the next domino to fall, is that the U.S. sovereign debt market hasn't performed worse than it's performed, and that mm-hmm. the term premium on long-term U.S. government bonds is still as low as it is. I mean, I think, you know, there's still some belief, excuse me, that we will get our act together. And inflation isn't a problem. And, you know, Congress will balance the budget and we'll go back to, you know, a steady state of financial health in the United States. Some part of the world has to believe that, or some part of the market, I should say, believes that. I mean, there are still, you know, 5 year by 5 year, you know, inflation swaps trading in the, I believe, 2.75, you know, percent range, up from where they were, by the way, a few years ago. But you know, the world is kind of now thinking we're kind of in a 2 or 3% inflationary world, and you know, the dollar isn't going to, you know, they can live with that. God knows why. If that's truly the case, anyone would buy a, you know, a 10-year bond, you know, yielding 4 something, and it's not much of a premium for that kind of inflation coming forward. But the point is that they do, and that there is a bond market still, and that's actually what I watch most closely for. In terms of, you know, what the next trigger will be. Well, I watch obviously the prices of the sound money alternatives, and they're both going up, hitting record highs. But I also watch interest rates on the bonds, because I think the next problem is going to become when more and more people realize, gee, this is a serious problem that can never be solved. You know, those bonds are going to get sold, and they're going to get sold hard. Because if you look at, you know, Grohman, his analogy. He says, you know, I know you've interviewed him many times. He's brilliant. You know, the bond market is the sucker at the table. You know, we're playing cards, and the bond market is the sucker. I mean, anyone who thinks they're going to be able to maintain real value by holding a long bond, you know, denominated in U.S. dollars, they're just out of their mind. I mean, you know, because, you know, the market doesn't see it yet, but as a result of the mathematical, you know, equations that you and I've discussed, and the way they're spending money, growing the debt, you know, and the fiscal deficits that they're running, you know, the need to debase the currency. I mean, it's cruelly what Richard Russell used to say, it's inflate or die. I mean, we have got to inflate this currency or else the whole thing is going to collapse. And, you know, the Fed knows that. I know that. You know that. A lot of sound money investors know that. Kind of unbelievably to me, the bond market doesn't know it yet or doesn't fully know it yet. But I think they're going to catch on. I think they're going to get a clue. And part possibly, you know, they don't know it yet because the bond market could be manipulated. I mean, as you and I both know, the Feds do manipulate a lot of markets, and it wouldn't surprise me to see them in there manipulating the bond market to some degree as well. I mean, we know they've done it with the jawboning. They certainly, you know, it's a little bit of a mystery, but that's, to me, that checklist is critical. You know what? I mean, when yield curve control comes at a federal level, you know, that'll be it. But, you know, just as we talked about earlier in the show, I mean, just the changing the SLR ratios is effectively yield curve control. So, you know, it's a lot of people, I think a mistake many investors make is and it's easy to make. And it's in many cases, it kind of works, is you tend to invest in the rearview mirror. And, you know, if something's worked, it'll keep on working. And, you know, a 40-year deflationary trend, I think it's very hard for investors to wrap their head around the idea that that trend has changed. And that we no longer live in a deflationary environment. And that for now, anyway, and until these monetary issues get addressed, we live in an inflationary world. And so in an inflationary world, bonds at the current prices just don't work. And as that becomes more acute, then you get into a very bad cycle where, you know, I mean, you look at how Argentinian currencies failed or how the Venezuelan currency failed. It's about, you know, when your bond market goes to shit and you can't pay your interest because your interest rates are high, and then you have to print the money to pay your interest. I mean, pretty soon, you know, it's like everyone becomes aware, and when everybody's aware, it's all over. I mean, I like to use the example of Silicon Valley Bank because I think it's very instructive. I mean, So this is in March of, you know, 2023. And, you know, they were in a position where they needed some liquidity. They sold some bonds. They had to sell them for much less than they had them carried for on their books. And they had to disclose that. And some of the analysts looked at it and they saw the discount they had to take on the sale of bonds. And they quickly did the math and they said, oh, my goodness, given the price they had to sell these bonds at, given how many bonds they have that look like this, this company is bankrupt. The Silicon Valley Bank, instead of having $20 billion of positive equity, they've got $20 billion of negative equity. And so that analyst called up a few of his friends who called up a few of his friends. And this is like the telephone game and out in on the West Coast. And, you know, several of the big venture capitalists had all their money and all their funds back, you know, in deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. And they, you know, quickly spread the word via phone and email to all the people. You know what? We're a little worried about all those deposits we've got in Silicon Valley Bank. You really should withdraw all your money. Mm-hmm. And so what we saw is within, you know, from the time they sold those bonds to the day it was bankrupt was like 6 days. And on one of those days, the total deposit base was about $100 billion. And on one of those days, $45 billion worth of money went out of the Silicon Valley Bank in one day. 45% of the deposit base in one day. I mean, this was a digital bank run, right? I mean, this was like, you know, it was like George Bailey in the savings and loan, except it was digital and it happened really quick. And I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, how did this happen? It happened because it went from where nobody was aware that the Silicon Valley Bank was bankrupt to the point where everybody was aware that the Silicon Valley Bank was bankrupt. And in a digitally connected world, very quickly, everyone acted to protect themselves and said, oh, my God, this thing's bankrupt. Get my money out of there. I'm only covered for $250 and we've got $2 million in there. Well, I don't want to lose the extra money. Get it out of there now. And so take that model just for a moment and apply it to the U.S. federal government and the U.S. federal government's finances. And so, you know, the bond market is failing and the Feds come out with an emergency program where they say, don't worry, we're going to backstop the entire bond market and set interest rates at 3%. And so, you know, very quickly, the bond market reacts and says, OK, Fed, sold to you. And suddenly, the Fed's balance sheet starts going up by trillions of dollars in days and weeks. And everybody sees that and says, holy shit, the entire bond market's getting sold to the federal government. You know, okay, fine. How much? Well, it's trillions of dollars. Okay, fine. Where are they getting the trillions of dollars to buy the bonds? Well, they don't really have it. It's not like they're running an excess surplus. Gosh, they're printing trillions of dollars to buy out the bond market. Oh my God, that printing trillions of dollars on a monetary base of a certain size, that means they're going to keep doing it. And that means maybe the money, you know, and suddenly you see where I'm going with this. Suddenly everybody comes to the conclusion that, oh shit, they can't stop and they're going to keep on going. Gosh, you know, everything I've got in dollars, it's not going to be worth anything because they're going to keep printing. And this is how Weimar happened. Okay. This, you know, they cannot stop printing money. I know that. I'm smart enough to realize it. And the phenomenon we're just describing is well known to everybody. It's called Gresham's Law, which is to say, once you realize a money is quickly becoming worth less, you rush to sell that money in favor of another form of money or assets that will not become worth less. And, you know, in Weimar, when people were getting paid, they immediately took their paycheck, used it to buy food because they knew that 2 days later, food would cost more. That's the point I'm trying to make here, that once the common knowledge is this is out of control and can never stop, it can happen rather quickly. You know, it happened rather quickly for the Silicon Valley Bank. And, you know, obviously that's a different condition. I mean, one bank is a different condition than an entire sovereign currency. So, you know, this is going to probably take years and a few more of these swings to play out. But the condition really isn't too different. And what it really involves is people, human beings, realizing, you know, coming to a conclusion about something and then acting to protect themselves based upon that conclusion. And this will be a case of, you know, he who panics first will panic best, because, you know, I mean, you want, you know, okay, great. I mean, it'll be hard too, because it's like, oh, you know, gee, Mr. Investor, the price of gold is 4,000. Gosh, only 6 months ago it was 2,000. That's a big increase. I'm not sure I want to pay 4,000. Well, you know, guess what? Maybe you should pay 4,000, because in another 6 months it's going to be 10,000. Mm-hmm. And eventually it's going to be infinity, because the dollars you have, you know, nobody's going to be willing to sell gold in exchange for dollars. You know, they're going to say to themselves, you know, I those dollars are worthless. I mean, you know, today in Venezuela, they use them to start, you know, to start fires. I mean, and as they did in Weimar, they, you know, the currency eventually becomes worthless. So, you know, I'm not trying to be a doomster. I'm not trying to be hyperbolic. I'm just literally repeating and emphasizing the, you know, the historical examples of this. You know, it's not as if we have not seen this before. Now, we haven't really seen it with the largest country with a reserve currency, you know, unless you argue that Rome had a reserve currency back in Roman times, but, you know, with a denarius, which they eventually diluted to be having zero value. But the point is, you know, you have seen similar things like this occur in other countries. And so, you know, my sense is that this is where we're ultimately headed, unless and until, you know, government gets responsible. And at any point in time, they could stop this process. You know, they could do monetary reform. I mean, monetary reform is not something that's impossible, but it takes political will. It takes political knowledge to do it. And I don't see any of those things. I don't see those present today. So that's kind of, you know, what we have to, sadly, what we have to kind of look forward to. I mean, I would say to try to be optimistic about all of this, you know, on the other side of this, and when hyperinflations have occurred or high inflations have occurred, generally speaking, people demand solutions. And when you create the solutions, you create sound money, everything will go back to being great. I mean, we can, you know, and it'll be, in fact, it'll be better than what we just suffered through. But you know, you've got to get to the other side where you're back on a sound money standard. Because as long as you're not on a sound money standard, this problem is going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, Larry, you know, you mentioned basically symptoms of this problem, which is, right, you know, gold and Bitcoin being at their all-time highs pretty much simultaneously. Yet, if we think about, you know, traditional price drivers of gold, like, let's say, real rates or, you know, the value of the DXY, those one would think should be a real headwind for gold at this time. So, you know, what do you think explains gold's breakout and really its stability here as well?
Yeah, it's really a great point, Tom. And I mean, I have to say, honestly, I'm a little bit shocked by it, but I, you know, my understanding, the best understanding I have it is as follows. I mean, you know, there's some really fabulous charts that show that the price of gold is correlated very much to real interest rates. I mean, when you can earn a good return on a real basis in places other than gold, well, you do it. Gold doesn't pay any interest. And so, you know, we saw real interest rates go up substantially when Powell decided to pretend like he was Volcker. And as a result of the fact, gold should have gone down. And it didn't. And to me, that was a clue. It was a big canary in the coal mine kind of clue. And the reason it didn't, in my opinion, is that gold is smart, or gold investors are smart, and they can see around the corner and they know that the big print is coming. And so as a result of that, you know, and it's also interesting, it's a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, a point I'll make is that if you actually see the U.S. ETFs in gold, they've been draining gold. Mm-hmm. I mean, U.S. investors have been net selling gold in the ETFs for a couple of years now. And yet the gold price hasn't gone down. That's another clue. I mean, what that tells you is that demand out of the central banks and demand out of China and the rest of the world. I mean, you know, the U.S. is, you know, 300 million people, whatever. I mean, there are 8 billion people in the world. And, you know, it's hard coded into most people's DNA that gold is money. And it's a sound form of money that can't be debased. And by the way, the rest of the world has had a lot more experience with debasement. I mean, the U.S., you know, has been relatively lucky, you know, other than the Continental in 1789 and the Civil War. I mean, the U.S. really hasn't had a hyperinflation or any kind of inflation, you know, any massive inflation except the 70s. Well, that's not entirely true. There was some after the World War II, too. But the point is that the U.S. has been monetarily stable compared to the rest of the world. And, you know, because the rest of the world, if you look at historically, there have been hyperinflations everywhere. I mean, you know, China, you name it. The list goes on and on. So, you know, and therefore, I think people are complacent and they kind of think, well, it can't happen here. But to answer your question, I think gold smells it. And that's why I think gold, you know, and it, to me, it's a clue. And you know, as Grohman points out, when suddenly markets stop behaving the way you think they should behave, or a relationship is broken, you need to ask yourself what created that break. And in this particular case, I think what has created that break is the knowledge that we're now really getting close to the end game. And that, you know, in spite of the fact that real interest rates have gone up 500 basis points as a result of Powell's actions, that doesn't matter anymore. People understand that gold is the solution. And so they're not selling their gold. In fact, they're buying more gold. And so, you know, it's a clue to my way of seeing it. And I think it's only going to get become a stronger clue as time goes on, because, you know, we're now, you know, anyone who looks at a long-term gold chart knows that, you know, we touched on 1900 back in 2011. You know, we bumped up against it a bunch of times now between 2020 and present. We just broke through it with authority. You know, we're you know, approaching 2200, and I fully expect us to squirt up to 2500, maybe 3000 this year. And with that, you know, that's clear. And you know, investors and people in general, everyone will see that. I mean, it's been amazingly quiet. And that's another clue to me that, you know, in the past, these kinds of breakouts would have been trumpeted from the rooftops, you know, because Bitcoin's been screaming. A lot of people have been focused over on the Bitcoin stuff. And so, you know, the gold market has just subtly been making these new highs. And, you know, eventually it's going to become obvious. The other piece that's kind of missing is, you know, the stock market has still hung in there. I mean, I've always thought that gold and stocks compete with one another in a certain sense that, you know, and there's historically, there's a lot of data to support this, that when the stock market does not do well, gold tends to do pretty well, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And, you know, until recently, I mean, this is another thing that surprised me in the past year. Until recently, the stock market's done pretty well, and it's done damn well. It's at, you know, record highs. I honestly thought when we hit the peak in, you know, 2022, that was it, that we had to put in a serious top in the stock market and the economy was going down. But as a result of the fiscal policies these guys have taken, you know, they've managed to keep the economy marching forward, you know, amazingly, and kept the stock market marching forward. I mean, you know, there is a lot of liquidity out there. And so, you know, that's been a surprise to me, but it is what it is. And, you know, I have to accept that as well, that, you know, I mean, and one thing to consider, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, it's interesting to consider that point, but if we look at the size, you know, let's just call it the market cap of each of those, it takes way, you know, proportionally way less currency to move the gold market than it does to continue the stock market where it has.
It really does. And that's why that's another argument that I make for these sound money assets. I mean, you know, if you look at all fiat assets in the world today, you know, there's been estimates that there's about $750 trillion of fiat assets. Let's say maybe half of that is real estate. So let's not count that. I mean, it is an investment asset, but it's not super liquid. So let's say maybe there's $350 trillion of investable assets, which I consider to be cash, stocks, and bonds. You know, the bond market is, I don't know, $100 trillion, $150 trillion. I mean, total gold market is $13 trillion today, maybe approaching $14 now. Total Bitcoin market is $1.4 trillion. I mean, it's, you know, a tenth the size of the gold market. Mm-hmm. I mean, if any of that 350, or as a piece of that 350, and this is what I believe is going on, as a piece of that 350 starts saying to itself, you know, I'm a little worried about, you know, these stocks. I'm a little worried about these bonds. I'm a little worried about this cash. I'm a little worried that these governments are going to continue to misbehave. I need to buy some insurance, which is really what gold is. They're going to come after gold. And you're right. It won't take, you know, a huge percentage change in those allocations to shove gold to much higher prices, because, you know, unlike the supply of fiat currency, the supply of gold doesn't grow very rapidly. You know, it's going up 1.7% a year. So,
and even if we consider that, you know, let's say the U.S. stock market money isn't coming out and going into gold, if it's coming from demand from other countries right now,
right?
That I think is really telling, as you said, you know, record Absolutely. Demand from other central banks. And then, you know, once the U.S., you know, equity managers figure that out, let's just, you know, hypothesize that they haven't at this point. Right. As we add that to it, it seems like a really exciting prospect.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around it. But, you know, as Richard Russell said, there's no fever like gold fever. And once this thing gets going, I think people are going to be shocked. I really do. You know, it's you know, I think Ronnie Stoffeli had a really great chart that showed, like, you know, 71% of the investment advisors in the United States have a lower than 1%, have either a 0 or a 1% allocation to gold. I mean, that's a shockingly low number when you consider the risk diversification that it provides you. I mean, over any time frame, it improves your portfolio performance. And, you know, it's just been completely demonetized, completely forgotten, completely badmouthed by the powers that be. And, you know, I mean, since 2020, it's outperformed the stock market, but nobody knows that, you know, because there's really no incentive in financial world, in Wall Street, to sell gold, because they can't make money selling it. They don't, you know, they don't make a spread on it. It's not tradable. You know, their business is selling stocks. And by the way, I mean, you know, to defend them, stocks have done damn well. I mean, they really have. In a, you know, when monetary conditions were much more, you know, friendly, and we didn't have all the problems that we have now, you know, stocks were by far a much better investment, you know, in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you know, they were growing in nominal and real terms. And so being invested in the stock market was a smart thing to do. And you know, there will always be a case for making investments in the stock market. I would just submit now that with the stock market at record highs and with the amount of gold outstanding, you know, with the value of gold very low relative to, you know, its historical, you know, comparison to the money supply, that it's a very, in my opinion, it's a very easy trade right now to sell stocks and buy gold. I think there will be a convergence between those two.
Mm-hmm. Larry, you quoted Jeremy Grantham in your year-end 2023 quarterly letter, where he said, "Value managers have always hated commodities. It feels completely out of their control, and it largely is. They're about as unpredictable as anything on the planet. And if you don't, if you go short, you die 1,000 deaths. And if you go long, it's pretty much as bad. I certainly don't recommend people to go short metals. If you can go long and throw away the key, I think that will do just fine. It does take nerves of steel, and you better have a good look at your nerves before you do it." So why do commodities seem out of control to value managers? Isn't there a fairly predictable cycle between commodities as they're underinvested and underdeveloped in for decades, only to, you know, return price-wise once this cycle, you know, continues?
It's a great question. I mean, I think there are those of us who would say it's not quite as bad as Jeremy is saying, that you can see the cycles, but to, you know, to defend him and his points, it is pretty goddamn hard. Do you know what I mean? I mean, the cycles are there. You don't know when they're going to start. You don't know when they're going to end. They're dependent upon a lot of huge macro factors, you know, and And investors, sadly, kind of quote unquote, tend to get it wrong. And there's a lot of volatility. And so, you know, I remember I started the business in the early 80s. And at that point in time, gold was loved. I mean, it just touched 800. Everyone thought it was a great investment. Stocks were hated. And of course, that was the wrong position on both of those, because gold was about to fall substantially and stocks were about to rally substantially. I know that in my case, my fund did very well in 2019 and 2020. And, you know, of course, a lot of people chased that performance and came in only before we had a pretty good size correction. And so it's volatile, and it's volatile enough, and it happens consistently enough that the average price chaser tends to get really chewed up doing commodity investing. Mm-hmm. You need to, you know, I mean, there's a time to buy them. There's a time to sell them. And you need to kind of dollar cost average and recognize which side of the ledger you're on. You know, are commodities cheap or are commodities expensive? And I think right now we're at one of those times where commodities are breathtakingly cheap. But there will come a time when they will become expensive. And, you know, at that point in time, I don't think I'll be owning commodities. I mean, they tend to actually be countercyclical with stocks. And, you know, my sense is, you know, they'll become a time when stocks will become incredibly cheap. I mean, I remember in the early 80s, you know, you could buy growing, decent stocks paying a dividend kind of that was substantial, at single digit PE multiples. I mean, this was, you know, and you compare that to the pricing today and it's just it's totally upside down. And so, but Jeremy, I mean, he makes a good point. It's a rough area to invest in. And I think the reason value managers don't like it is it's based on macro, and value managers tend to want to, you know, they want to find steady companies that they can understand the fundamentals on and then buy them when they're cheap relative to their fundamentals. And, the fundamentals on commodities are always somewhat opaque and they're somewhat driven by the macro factors that are around. And so, you know, I don't claim to have any, crystal ball on commodity pricing. But I do know that when generally speaking, if you can buy things when they're on the cheaper side of the ledger ratio wise, and you know, there's a great chart that compares the S&P 500 to the Goldman Sachs commodity ratio, and we're right down at the bottom of the chart, and you know, i.e. commodities cheap, gold, you know, S&P expensive, that things do tend to mean revert over time. But I emphasize the over time. Because, you know, last year or two hasn't been particularly great to be a gold stock investor. You know, in fact, it's been shitty. But, you know, I don't measure my performance for my investors. I mean, I point all my investors when they come in, I say, look, this is a 5-year bet. You know, I think, and if we're right, we're going to be spectacularly right. We're not going to just make 10% a year. We're going to make multiples of our money. But I can't honestly tell you if that's going to happen in a year or four years. But I do think that as mean reversion occurs as a result of the macro things we've discussed, it will work. And I still believe that very strongly. This thesis is going to work, I think, rather stunningly so. The thing that's, I think, going to be hard for people is it'll work stunningly so. And then some people say, oh, that's great. I got to jump in there. And they'll jump in, you know, after those of us who've been at it for a while have made, you know, multiples on our money. And right then we'll have a drawback, you know, and then they'll think, oh, shit, have I done the right thing? And they might sell out. Do you know what I mean? And there'll probably be a higher wave coming. But, you know, it's they're volatile. I guess that's the right way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And this actually tracks to Bitcoin, too. It's volatile. They're volatile. And so, you know, one needs to understand what one is buying, why one is buying it, and what kind of time frame you're buying it for. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, look, in the stuff we buy, the stuff I buy, you know, I'm very accustomed to buying something and having it go down 20%. And if nothing has changed and I fundamentally like it, you know, the way I view that is, you know, that's an opportunity to buy more and average down. But unfortunately, a lot of investors don't look at things that way. They want instant gratification and they're not willing to take a longer term view.
I think that time preference or time frame investing is really important, especially you know, in this environment where we're seeing, as we said earlier, this ball get kicked down the road further and further than, you know, a lot of people are expecting. So I think it is very important to go into any of these investments with that in mind, that this is, you know, in some ways an eventuality, but that is going to take, or let's say it's unpredictable in its timeline for a payout.
I think that's really important, Tom. And it's been very, very hard for a lot of investors. A lot of people bought this stuff. And I mean, you know, and we live in a soundbite world, an instant gratification world, and this, that, and the other world. But, you know, those who bought good things cheap and wait long enough, they will be rewarded. I'm absolutely positively convinced of that. And, but it's hard. I mean, it's extremely, and, you know, by the way, when you're rewarded, everyone thinks, oh, that was easy and that was obvious. And I mean, well, no, it wasn't. I mean, it was, you know, it was incredibly hard because in the interim, there are all kinds of things trying to knock you off the horse. You know, I mean, you know, Bill Miller is a great value investor and he's also a growth investor. And he bought, he saw Amazon early and he got it. He kind of understood what they were doing. I saw it too. I missed it because I thought they're not making any money. Therefore I don't want to buy it. But he got what they were building and he took a big position in it, first funds. And I think he rode through, I don't know, three or four, maybe more, drawdowns, you know, where Amazon went down over 50%, from its price. So, and you know, a lot of people, well, Amazon's dead, and yet it wasn't, and he held on to it the whole thing. And but you know, the average investor buying something, you know, if you know, okay, they buy it, it works, it goes up, but then it draws down 50%, or say they buy it at a peak and it draws down 50%. Well, they think, shit, I've made a mistake, you know, and they sell it, and you know, if they don't really understand what they've got, they don't really understand the long-term trend, and they're not willing to give, you know, to let the benefits of time play out on their thesis. And really, you know, anybody in investing who sits around and plays with a compounding calculator comes to realize that if you can create positive compounding over time, the numbers can get really big and you'll have investment success. But it's that, you know, that over time piece that's really hard for a lot of people to accept. I mean, it's no fun. I mean, it's no fun sitting in a position that's down 30 or 40% and saying to yourself, huh, I don't get it. This is a good situation. Company's growing. They're making money. It's super cheap. You know, why doesn't the market see it? But it doesn't. And, you know, that's why, you know, successful value investors get paid the big bucks. I mean, you know, there have been guys, I mean, you know, you look at like Tom Kaplan, who, you know, bought commodities when they were out of favor and bought copper and, you know, a number of different properties, just dirt cheap when they were way out of favor, and then just let 10 or 15 years do its thing. And now he's a billionaire. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about here. Things are generationally cheap in this asset category. And, you know, I fully expect that a lot of the companies in my portfolio will be 5 and 10 baggers, you know, over a 5 to 7 year window. You know, not tomorrow, but over a longer time frame. And so, you know, now, so the first question an investor has to ask is, can you wait 5 to 7 years? Because if you can't, don't do it. You know, sit on your cash, do something else. I mean, you know, or just buy gold. I mean, you know, gold has consistently gone up 8% a year, and it does protect your purchasing power. So it's always a decent choice. But once you get into the equity world, the commodity equity world, it's a rough ride. There's no doubt about that.
You know, Larry, it's interesting to consider if we're talking about 5 to 10 baggers over the next, let's just call it 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
How do we separate the devaluation of the currency aspect of that growth chart versus the actual appreciation of the underlying equity itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is that. Certainly, you know, some of the return that we get, if we have a 10 bagger and the cost structure of the whole world goes up 2x, well, you really only got a 5 bagger, right? I mean, I think that's what you're alluding to, that you, mm-hmm. you know, you need a 10 bagger to beat inflation. And that's true. I mean, you know, the good news is that at least by being invested, you know, I mean, if you'd been in cash, you know, you'd have lost half of your purchasing power in the same scenario. So, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that some of the return that I'm describing is a function of, you know, the monetary debasement, which is taking place in parallel, you know, with the growth of these assets. But that is what it is, right? That's what we're aiming to protect against. And, you know, what you're describing is the difference between nominal and real returns. I mean, the real return is the amount that you got ahead, you know, on an inflation adjusted basis. The nominal return is the 10x. But, you know, it's often, you know, people say, oh, this is great. I mean, gold can go to, $10,000 an ounce. Well, that's great. And that would be good for all of us who hold gold. We'd love that. You know, the flip of that is, you know, gasoline might also cost $50 a gallon. And that's what you're describing. And I think, you know, I think both of those things are going to happen. I mean, I think, you know, there's a pretty good chance gold is going to $10,000 an ounce, and there's a pretty good chance gasoline will cost $50 a gallon. But I think if you look at, you know, the math on it, you still would have gotten ahead by holding the gold. Just barely. Like I said, gas is $3 now. That's actually in that case, maybe not. But my point is that, you know, nominal and real are important, as you point out.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Larry. Well, that's all the questions I have for you today. Is there anything else that you'd like to
I would encourage all gold people to to keep your head up and realize that you're in the right place. Even though it hasn't necessarily felt that way. And I think it's ironic that gold's hitting new highs and people aren't excited about it. Trust me, they will be. I think that what we are looking at here is very clearly a sovereign debt crisis, which will ultimately, in my opinion, lead to a currency crisis. And as a result of those two things, everybody needs to, in terms of their savings or their assets, they need to have a good portion of those assets in things which the government can't print. Mm-hmm. Because I think that will be the story of the next 5 or 10 years, very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. So,
excellent. Larry, thank you so much for your time today. If there's anybody that wants to hear more of Larry's work, read his quarterly reviews. That's available at ema2.com. And of course, you're an excellent Twitter follow at Lawrence Lepard. Larry, thanks so much for
sharing. Thank you, Tom. I always enjoy talking to you. You always have great questions. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.